Stephen Huff playing that. They're playing this, the Polonaise number 2 in E major, and he's playing Mendelssohn and the Proms on the 19th of August, the concerto number 1 in G minor with the Scottish Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Robin Ticciati. Well, Proms every night, we're going there shortly. Just time for me to remind you that we've got more wonderful guests coming tomorrow. Peter Frankel will be here, about to appear at the Oxford Philharmonia Piano Festival. He's playing Schumann for us, and Violetta Ormano will be joining me as she prepares for the role of Isolde in Wagner's opera Tristan and Isolde. It's not just the ring that's at the Proms at the moment. Adriano Varela is bringing his band, Plus Band, Transfigured Tango he's calling it, and we'll be celebrating the National Children's Orchestra's 35th anniversary. But now at 7:30 here on Radio 3, it's time to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's Prom. It's presented by Martin Handley.
Thank you very much indeed, Sean. Hello and welcome to the Royal Albert Hall. My first visit of the 2013 season. As always, the buzz of this grand old building catches me off guard. Of course, this year's BBC Proms are full of performances for the 200th anniversary of the births of Wagner and Verdi, the 100th of Benjamin Britten. One of the other highlights is a Tchaikovsky symphony cycle, and that begins tonight with his fourth autobiographical music, Railing Against Fate. It's in the hands of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Jacques Van Steen, whose seven-year stint as principal guest conductor has just come to an end. The rest of their programme this evening is English, including portraits of one of Shakespeare's most endearing characters, Sir John Falstaff, by Elgar and by Walton. And in the Proms Plus literary interval, Timothy West talks about his experience of playing the role. After the Elgar, Raphael Walfisch is the soloist in the first Proms performance of Granville Bantock's sapphic poem for cello and orchestra, Tchaikovsky-influenced music of great beauty. But we begin with Falstaff. Elgar had loved Shakespeare ever since, as a boy, he spent time in his father's workshop with an odd-job man who'd been a Shakespearean actor. They recited scenes together, and over time, Elgar became something of an authority on the playwright. He completed his symphonic study, Falstaff, in 1913, and said of it, "Falstaff is the name, but Shakespeare, the whole of human life, is the theme." The piece opens with musical portraits of Falstaff and his crony Prince Hal before their exploits begin in the Boar's Head Tavern, where the two men are joking with the landlady. They head off to ambush a convoy of bullion at Gad's Hill, after which Falstaff is himself ambushed by a disguised Prince Hal. Back at the tavern, Sir John boasts of his adventure before dozing off and dreaming of when he was page boy to the Duke of Norfolk. The action resumes as Falstaff leads his scarecrow army into battle. Returning home, he visits his friend Justice Shallow, falls asleep in the Justice's orchard, and has an idyllic dream of an eternally peaceful England. The finale begins with the news of Prince Hal's accession to the throne. Falstaff rides to London to be at his side for the coronation, but is brutally dismissed. "I know thee not, old man, fall to thy prayers." Falstaff takes to his bed, alone with his memories of past happiness, and dies. Well, the leader of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, Leslie Hatfield, has already tuned the orchestra. They're all joined on the Royal Albert Hall stage by Jacques Van Steen. They conduct Elgar's symphonic study, Falstaff.
Thank you. Thank you.
elderly, rejected Falstaff dies quietly, almost insignificantly, at the end of Elgar's symphonic study. It was played to open tonight's prom in the Royal Albert Hall by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Jacques Van Steen, live here on Radio 3, home of the BBC proms. And the first thing Jacques Van Steen did was to get the principal bassoon of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales to his feet, Yaroslav Augustiniak. Lots of wonderful instrumental solos throughout that. And for Elgar, Falstaff, as complex a man as Hamlet. Well, a decade or so before Elgar wrote Falstaff, Granville Bantock was composing his song cycle Sappho, setting words by the 7th century BC poetess of Lesbos, in translation by his wife Helen. That work took Bantock some 3 years to complete. In the middle of it, he wrote a related but independent piece, his Sapphic poem for cello and orchestra, originally with piano, orchestrated in 1909, and that receives its proms premiere tonight with Raphael Walfisch as soloist. It's the first of five proms performances of Bantock's music this year. He came from a medical family, seems to have tried to avoid becoming a musician, training first as a chemical engineer, then for the Indian Civil Service, before finally giving in and heading for the Royal College of Music, just down the steps from us here at the Royal Albert Hall. He first became known as a conductor, learning his trade on a world tour with a variety company in the 1890s, before being appointed director of music to the Tower Orchestra New Brighton on Merseyside, where his championing of contemporary music won him a national reputation. Sibelius dedicated his third symphony to Bantock. It wasn't long before he became known as an important composer in his own right. Bantock was a man of many enthusiasms. He became interested in the world of ancient Greece, wrote a whole series of works which were basically orchestral tone poems on classical subjects. I asked Raphael Walfisch for his thoughts on Bantock and his music for cello.
There is a lot of cello music. I mean, there are sonatas with piano, there are five more of these poems, well, four, five altogether. There's no concerto as such. They're all called dramatic poem or Celtic poem or something like that. And they are between 10 and 15 minute works, mostly with orchestra, which really deserve to be heard.
And the Sapphic poem he wrote as a sort of outrigger to the poems he was setting at the time.
That's right, this great oratorio with mezzo-soprano, which is something like an hour long. Mm. Incredible music. And yes, this is maybe a shaving from the bench. It's a kind of Scena, an operatic scene with the cello as protagonist.
And he had very wide-ranging passions. He was clearly a very passionate man.
Yeah,
passions
must have
for the East and ancient Greece.
Very
as
much
we
so, very much so, yes. And I think particularly for literature in general, a lot of his works have literary connotations and titles and so on. He was obviously a very intelligent and sensitive person.
When you're playing, you talk of it as being a Scena.
Yeah.
When you're playing it, do you have a vision of what?
Yes. It is. It's such rhetorical music, and it's telling a story for sure.
Raphael Walfisch, and now here he comes onto the Albert Hall platform, followed by Jacques Van Steen, and joining the BBC National Orchestra of Wales to give the first proms performance of Bantock's Sapphic poem. That was the first BBC Proms performance of Granville Bantock's Sapphic Poem for Cello and Orchestra. The soloist here in the Royal Albert Hall, Raphael Balfitch for the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Jacques Van Steen. Well, Bantock did incredible things with the Tower Orchestra in New Brighton as a young man, turning it from scratch dance band to serious orchestra, conducted by Sibelius Elgar and Joseph Holbrook, among others. But he also was very into teaching, became principal of Birmingham School of Music, professor of music at Birmingham University. And the man coming back onto the platform now, Raphael Balfitch, he also is busy teaching this summer, both in Canada at Banff and Quebec, and in Holland and Italy. And I think with Jacques Van Steen already on the platform and a little conversation going on with Raphael Balfitch, we might be going to get some more right now. If the applause stops, that is.
It's wonderful to launch this renaissance of Bantock, and we would like to play Hamabdil, which is a setting by Bantock of the final prayer of the Sabbath service.
Granville Bantock's Hamabdil, the original title, Hebrew melody. Raphael Walsh's encore with the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Jacques Van Steen. Another little bit of Bantock to get us underway for this year's proms. The comedy overture Pierrot of the Minute will be coming along on the 31st of July, and his Celtic Symphony on the 21st of August. Raphael Walsh says he's particularly looking forward to going to the Concert House in Vienna the day after Kristallnacht in November to play music by composers definitely not asked for at that time, Korngold and Zemlinsky among them. Back he comes onto the platform here in the Albertall. Wonderful smile, Raphael Walsh. Hugely appreciated both by the audience in the Albertall and by the orchestra, I think. Also going to play the string orchestra version of the Schumann Cello Concerto, which Raphael told me was the original version that Schumann wanted to make. He never made it, but this is going back to what Schumann originally wanted to do. Well, now, there's a chance for those of us here in the Albertall to cool down before the second half of tonight's BBC Prom. Live, of course, as is every concert in the season, on Radio 3, home of the proms. In the second half, we've another portrait of Sir John Falstaff, this one from William Walton's score for the film of Henry V. There's an hors d'oeuvre, you might say, before the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and Jacques Van Steen begin the proms' Tchaikovsky symphony cycle with his fourth, the work in which he confronts an implacable fate. But it's Falstaff who occupies us for the next 20 minutes here on Radio 3 from a Proms Plus literary event held earlier this evening down the road at the Royal College of Music, when Timothy West and Desmond Barrett talked to Samira Ahmed about their experiences playing the role.
Tonight, I'm talking to Timothy West and Desmond Barrett about Falstaff, one of the most enduring of Shakespeare's fictional characters. Thanks to Shakespeare, Falstaff looms large in the imagination of composers such as Elgar and Verdi. Elgar focused on the pathos, Verdi on the bawdy humour. Henry IV, Parts 1 and 2, has both, of course, with Falstaff's vital complexity at the heart of both the epic history and the exploration of English manhood, particularly fatherhood. Between them, my guests have racked up five acclaimed Falstaffs. Timothy West has played him twice in Henry IV at Bristol's Old Vic and the London Old Vic, and Desmond Barrett has played him twice in Henry IV, including for Peter Hall in 2011, and most recently in The Merry Wives of Windsor for the Royal Shakespeare Company. Desmond, Falstaff is unusual as a Shakespeare character in that he's physically identifiable by his silhouette alone, that beard, that belly. I mean, it could almost be a panto role. What's the appeal? How do you play him?
Well, I thought you were going to say, obviously, you are ideal casting. But fortunately, both times I've played Falstaff, I've had to have padding, strangely enough, because even Falstaff is larger than what I am. But it's, I mean, the great thing about doing Henry IV particularly, Henry IV Parts 1 and Part 2, is that they play around about 8 hours. Now, with most plays, of course, you get 2.5, 3 hours to develop a character. With Falstaff, you get 8 hours, and that is fantastic. So you can cover the whole gamut of emotions, you know what I mean? You can cover the whole character very easily in that space of time.
And in preparing, I mean, didn't you wear your fat suit around and you grew your own beard rather than have a false one, is that right?
I grew my own beard when I did it at the RSC in 2001 because I had to come to this rubber flange in the floor. And I thought if I have a stick-on beard, I could imagine that, you know, 5 times out of 6, the beard would be left down the hole and there'd be a beardless Falstaff on stage. So I grew a beard. And I remember during this period, I went to New York and got to the, you know, the security people, you know, and they look at your passport. And, of course, I didn't have a beard on the passport. And the first thing this guy looked at me, he said, "My God, it's Santa Claus." And I must admit, I realized how old I was then because the beard was white. And my natural color hair was sort of mousy, I suppose. But the beard was white. And I suddenly realized I was getting on.
Timothy,
I was the right age for Falstaff.
Well, I wonder how you regarded preparing for the role, and indeed this idea that is it a role you take on at a certain stage in life?
You find out who the character is by looking at the text. I think it's very important to have an idea who Falstaff actually is, although we don't know much about his childhood. I think he's very clearly a gentleman, by which I mean clearly that he was brought up as such. I think that he's been allowed to get away with things for so long, argues that somewhere there's an old school tie, a bit tattered and beer-stained somewhere, that's given him license to go on. And I think that sometimes you find in the scene that he has with the Lord Chief Justice in part two, when he's being told off, it sounds to me very like university common room chat. I wonder if they were actually at Oxford together, he and the Lord Chief Justice.
And you've thought of the role as being, in a sense, it's in a play that's about death, is that right, all the way through?
No, I think the first part is very much about life. The second part is about dying. The central relationship between Falstaff and Hal is going off. Everything is running down. The king's getting older and, in fact, dying. The rebels are no longer people like Hotspur and rebels in part two are dull old bishops and politicians. That's what makes the two plays such a wonderful round piece of entertainment. Ideally, everybody should see both parts in a day.
Now, Timothy, what's interesting about one of your Falstaffs is, of course, your son, Samuel West, played Hal to your Falstaff in 1996. Now, he told me, my main memory of Henry IV is rehearsing the first scene with Hal and Falstaff, and at one point, picking up my father's script by mistake, he in turn picked up mine, which read, "Palliate the follies I can neither avoid nor deny." And at the same point, his read, "Pick up boot." Does that offer some insight into the character, indeed your preparation?
I hope not, no. We just happened to have our scripts open at the same page, and he'd written this long, long thing, because he that's what he does. He writes a lot of notes about his background thoughts. And mine was a practical thing at this point. Don't forget to pick up the boot.
Falstaff as a character is most memorable in the play, in the performance for his appetites, you know, for life in general, but more literally through drink. And it can almost seem like a moral duty. What Shakespeare has him say on the subject of sack, or sherry as we'd call it now, can seem like a statement of belief. And it seems a good moment to hear the voice of Falstaff. Timothy, perhaps you'd like to start us off.
Yes. This is Falstaff sitting on a log well away from the heat of the battle, and giving some advice to the young boy who's been given the job of being his page.
"A good sherry sack hath a twofold operation in it. It ascends me into the brain, dries me there all the foolish and dull and crudy vapours which environ it, makes it apprehensive, quick, fortitive, full of nimble, fiery, and delectable shapes, which, delivered o'er to the voice, the tongue, which is the birth, becomes excellent wit. The second property of your excellent sherries is the warming of the blood, which before, cold and settled, left the liver white and pale, which is the badge of pusillanimity and cowardice. But the sherries warms it and makes it course from the innards to the parts extremes. It illumineth the face, which, as a beacon, gives warning to all the rest of this little kingdom man to arm. And then the vital commoners and inland petty spirits muster me all to their captain the heart, who, great and puffed up with this retinue, doth any deed of courage. And this valour comes of sherries."
So that skill in the weapon is nothing without sack, for that sets it a work. Hereof comes it that Prince Harry is valiant. For the cold blood he did naturally inherit of his father, he hath, like lean, sterile, and bare land, manured, husbanded, and tilled, with excellent endeavour of drinking good, and good store of fertile sherries, that he is become very hot and valiant. If I had 1,000 sons, the first human principle I would teach them should be to forswear thin potations and to addict themselves to sack.
Thank you. Desmond, how should we be reading that now? How should we listen to it now?
You should find it very funny. I mean, it is one of the characteristics of Falstaff. That's, you know, he loves drink. Can I just read a couple of lines from the first part one? It's the first scene with Hal and Falstaff, and they have been out drinking the night before and slept in late. And Falstaff wakes up, doesn't know what the time is, and says to Hal, "Now, Hal, what time of day is it, lad?" And Hal says, "What a devil hast thou to do with the time of day? Unless hours were cups of sack, and minutes capons, and clocks the tongues of boards, and dials the sun of leaping houses, and the blessed sun himself, a fair hot wench in flame-coloured taffeta, I see no reason why you should be so superfluous to demand the time of the day." And that, to me, sums up what Falstaff is about, or what Hal perceives what Falstaff is about. And we were talking about approaching a part. Of course, when you read a script, what I do is I find out what everybody, how everybody describes Falstaff, what their opinion of Falstaff is, what Falstaff says about himself. And then that way you decide which of these things are true, which of them are just suppositions on other people's parts, and you develop a character. But you grow as a Falstaff with the rest of the cast.
But there's more than that, Timothy, isn't there? Because of the part is a man who's full of boasts, and who also has lived this great life, which we're not entirely sure about. You can see the possibility for reading into it of a life that didn't quite go according to plan, and a life slightly looking back with regret. And I just wonder how far in Falstaff's you've seen yourself. It's made a difference if there's been a life story like it.
My wife's sitting here somewhere. I hope she thinks that my life has not been entirely like Falstaff.
Has he been a hellraiser? You can tell us.
No, but of course you find things in your own experience. Every part you play, you find things in your own experience, just as you find things from observation of people that you meet or see on the tube or have come across in one way or another. And it's never a complete portrait. It's an amalgam of hundreds and hundreds of different things which might give you clues as to how they look, how they talk, how they use their faces, how they walk, how they sit, how they listen. But that's the case for any part, you know. It's not just an extreme person like Falstaff.
Of course, if you have to put on a fat suit, that takes a lot of care of the physicality of the character. You don't have to act fat.
Absolutely.
You become fat, you know.
A key theme in Henry IV, parts one and two, is this theme of fatherhood, and there are these powerfully contrasting fathers and sons, you know, the king and Falstaff, Hotspur and Hal. And Timothy, just, I wondered, having played Falstaff opposite your son, how was it playing the ultimate kind of anti-father, in a way, with your actual son?
Yes, well, it was very interesting, because it's the play is about surrogate fathers and surrogate sons, isn't it? I mean, the king wishes that Hotspur had been his son rather than the wastrel Hal. Hal wishes that Falstaff had been his father rather than the stern old king. I think Sam and I sort of explored things in each other, some of which perhaps were rather distasteful.
You were still talking at the end of the production, which was quite impressive.
We were still talking at the end. Yes, we were. Yes, we were. Yeah. And we shared digs in several places. Yes. And we were all right.
Which is a good point, I think, to bring in our next reading. The love for each other they show is kind of clear in their clowning in Act Two of Henry IV, Part One. Timothy, I think you're going to read us a bit from that.
Yes, this is a game that they play at the Boar's Head, where Falstaff is pretending to be the king, giving a telling off to his son, and also advising him on the fact that he's found some rather bad companions. "And there is a virtuous man who I am often noted in thy company, but I know not his name." And the prince says, "What matter of man, and it like your majesty?" "A goodly portly man, i' faith, and a corpulent, of a cheerful look, a pleasing eye, and a most noble carriage. And as I think his age some
50, or, by our lady, inclining to 80. And now I remember me, his name is Falstaff. If that man be lewdly given, he deceiveth me, for, Harry, I see virtue in his looks. If then the tree may be known by the fruit, as the fruit by the tree, then peremptorily I speak it, there is virtue in that Falstaff. Him keep with, the rest banish.
The charm is so apparent in speeches like that. Desmond, one critic wrote of your Falstaff that you captured his easy, companionable charm, but equally that you never sentimentalised his calculating cruelty. Mm-hmm. And what do you make of his moral character? Is he ever really virtuous?
Well, I mean, the thing is, you know, Hal gets certain things from Falstaff, and Falstaff is hoping to get certain things off Hal. He wants what's the title? Dukedom. And so he hangs around there hoping that he will get a dukedom eventually. So they both are using each other, in effect. And this development, it's not too apparent in Act One, although in the scene that Timothy has just spoken that speech from, there's an intimation of that, because Hal turns on Falstaff and basically criticizes him, calls him a fat, ugly man, a user, calls him all the things that we see happen at the end of Part Two, when eventually Hal becomes Henry V. And Falstaff goes to him and he says, the first thing he says is, I think, something to the effect like, I know thee not, old man. And that's absolutely devastating for Falstaff. Suddenly he's been slapped in the face, you know, by this young man that he's loved for years, and
is
not going to get whether he deserves a dukedom is beside the point, but he deserves the friendship of this guy. But of course, you become a king, you suddenly have responsibility. So your history, your past, is thrown to one side.
It does seem like the cruelest line in Shakespeare. How do you see it when that's said to you?
It must be a cruel blow, but I think he's seen it coming. I think he's given an intimation of it. I mean, at the very end of that speech, the prince's reply to that speech, Falstaff, still pretending to be the king, says, banish not him, thy Harry's company, banish Falstaff, and banish all the world.
Yes. And of course,
and Hal says, I do.
Yes, I will. I will, yes.
We have another reading, Desmond, that... perhaps you could do for us. It's a famous passage which illustrates Falstaff's apparent attitude to honour.
Yes, this is at the battle in Shrewsbury, or Shrewsbury, however you pronounce it. And this scene's a very episodic. You see different elements of the battle happening. And Hal and Falstaff come along, bump into each other. And Falstaff says to Hal, I would 'twere bedtime, Hal, and all well. He doesn't want to be there. And Hal says to him, why, thou owest God a death. And Falstaff replies this, 'tis not due yet. I would be loath to pay him before his day. What need I be so forward with him that calls not on me? Well, 'tis no matter. Honour pricks me on. Yea, but how if honour prick me off when I come on? How then? Can honour set to a leg? No. Or an arm? No. Or take away the grief of a wound? No. Honour hath no skill in surgery then? No. What is honour? A word. What is in that word, honour? What is that honour? Air. A trim reckoning. Who hath it? He that died a Wednesday. Doth he feel it? No. Doth he hear it? No. 'Tis insensible then, yea, to the dead.
But will it not live with the living? No. Why? Detraction will not suffer it. Therefore, I'll none of it. Honour is a mere scutcheon, and so ends my catechism.
Thank you, Desmond. Is that really sort of how Falstaff remains at the end, do you think, of part two?
At the end of
part two. Defiant on the outside, however.
Oh, I think so, yes. I mean, you know, he's, God knows. I mean, the thing is, he's a man that's lived on positivity all his life. Everything's been not right, but he's made it right for him. And what happens, he gets taken to prison, banished. So what happens then is obviously Henry 4.5, part three. Then we have Merrywives of Windsor, which is a completely different Falstaff.
Well, let's talk about that because, you know, Shakespeare famously created the first prequel in seeing the box office potential of Falstaff in the, you know, the joyous days and giving him the Merrywives. And globally, over the centuries, there's been much more focus on the jolly Falstaff as a kind of John Bull. I wonder, Timothy, is it wrong to see him as a sort of as an emblematic kind of un-PC Englishman, which is somehow, I think, how he is seen at first glance by people who don't know the plays?
No, I think there's a special attitude in the Merrywives that it's a parochial play about parochial people who think that it's quite fun to actually be made love to, or to be thought to be made love to, by a fat old knight simply because he is a knight and from London.
Falstaff in Merry Wives looks in the mirror and doesn't see what he really is. He sees Keanu Reeves. You know, he thinks he's Mr. Even though he's aging, he sees Mr. Gorgeous, and he can't quite understand why these people don't just fall head over heels for him. And of course, they plan all sorts of tricks. They put him in a basket. They throw him in the Thames.
It's essentially and of a course, sort of 16th century sitcom.
Yes, absolutely. It's just a bit of froth. Okay. But it is quite sad as well, because at the end, everybody turns on him.
I think, sadly, that's all we have time for. Thank you again to Timothy West and to Desmond Barrett.
Thank you.
That was Samira Ahmed in conversation with Timothy West and Desmond Barrett. The producer was Zahid Worley. Don't forget, there's a Proms Plus every day during the season. You can find out all about them by going online. Welcome back to a very warm Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handley, where for every concert in the 2013 Proms, we're live here on Radio 3, of course, home of the BBC Proms. Performers tonight, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Jacques Van Steen. And in a few minutes, they'll be starting a proms cycle of Tchaikovsky symphonies. Tchaikovsky wrote his fourth symphony during the most extraordinary year of his life, 1877, when his feelings of guilt about his homosexuality and fear of its being discovered tormented him to the extent that he impulsively married a young student he hardly knew. It was a disastrous step, and within a few weeks, he'd fled from her to his sister's house. He was on the brink of a breakdown before he was able to get a doctor's note to release him from his teaching obligations in Moscow and set out on a long escapist trip, really, to Italy, during which he worked on the symphony. He'd actually been constructing the framework of the piece at precisely the moment the student first wrote to him, when he was already haunted by what he saw as the destructive nature of fate. Fate, which he said, describing the opening of the symphony, prevents the impulse to happiness from achieving its goal. You can only reconcile yourself to it and languish fruitlessly. The two middle movements of the symphony then seem to move into the realm of escapism. Tchaikovsky said the first of them was about the melancholy feeling which comes in the evening when you're sitting alone and there come a whole host of memories. And as for the famous pizzicato scherzo, well, that's apparently full of the kind of strange, incoherent pictures that fly around your head when you're half asleep. In the finale, Tchaikovsky claims to be turning his back on fate. He wrote, "If within yourself you find no reasons for joy, look at others. Not everything in the world is sad. There are simple but strong joys." But before Tchaikovsky, we turn back briefly to Shakespeare's great creation, Sir John Falstaff, Elgar's portrait of whom got us underway this evening. Now we turn to William Walton as a brilliant film composer. Laurence Olivier, producer, director and star of Henry V, was delighted to have Walton on board. His verdict was William knocked out the most fantastic score. Why it didn't win every award throughout the film industry, I'll never know. And tonight we hear the two most intimate numbers from that score. Touch Her Soft Lips and Part captures Pistol's tender farewell to his new wife, Mistress Quickly, before he sets off for the war. And then comes a lament on the death of Falstaff, based on the Elizabethan drinking song, Watkin's Ale. Now, here once again, Jacques van Steen, rejoining the BBC National Orchestra of Wales to conduct those two pieces for strings from Walton's music for Henry V. The Death of Falstaff, the second of those two haunting miniatures for strings from Walton's music for Laurence Olivier's 1944 film of Shakespeare's Henry V. Performed to begin the second half of this BBC Prom here at the Royal Albert Hall by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Jacques Van Steen. So now we reach the first instalment of the cycle of Tchaikovsky symphonies being performed in this year's BBC Proms. I asked tonight's conductor, Jacques Van Steen, for his thoughts on Tchaikovsky's fourth and what he focuses on when conducting the piece.
The first movement could be a symphonic poem on its own already. So it's 20-odd minutes of fantastic, difficult, obscure, modern rhythms, far ahead of his time. And then you get the obligatoire andante with a nice folky melody and a scherzo that is pretty unique to play pizzicato that long just for the strings and then interrupting with a whole sort of marching wind band passing by and then a too short a finale. If you look at the score as a first reader, I'm not Rubinstein who conducted it, but I try to be in that era, and if you see what he writes, the clean writing and not my interpretation of doing, oh, we do a diminuendo. Why do we do a diminuendo? It's not written. He knew the word diminuendo. And I said to the orchestra, because the orchestra knows the piece very well, but all with interpretations of the last years. And I asked them to rub everything out, and then you get a fresh approach to a piece that everybody knows. And that aspect I try to achieve tonight, the excitement of the premiere of Tchaikovsky 4.
Jacques Van Steen, and here he is returning to the Albert Hall platform to conduct the BBC National Orchestra of Wales in Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony.
Thank you.
Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony, ending in a blaze of glory. A kind of musical confession of a troubled soul, the whole work, though, performed here at the Royal Albert Hall, live on Radio 3, by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, led by Leslie Hatfield and conducted by Jacques Van Steen, who said what he was trying to do was get back to what Tchaikovsky wrote and clean up all the old habits that had grown. And as you heard, they really play for him, this orchestra. He's very happy that they still work hard for him after 7 years. He says they can play anything, but what he wants from them is sound, sound, sound. Jacques Van Steen is ambling through the orchestra to the wind section. David Cowley, who has that terribly exposed solo at the start of the slow movement, going through them. Robert Plain, the clarinetist. Matthew Featherstone, the flautist. Yaroslav Augustiniak, the bassoonist. Lawrence Davis, horn. Philip Schatz, the principal trumpet. And a special round of applause for Eva Stewart, the piccolo player. They're all being going around the entire wind and brass, I think. Next Tchaikovsky Symphony, the 5th on Friday the 2nd of August here in the Royal Albert Hall. Jacques Van Steen off to Opera North in September to conduct Peter Grimes. That should be some show. And he starts as principal guest of the Prague Symphony in December. Spending a lot of the autumn here, also conducting the Philharmonia in Prokofiev and Tchaikovsky, the Coco Variations. As for the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, well, they haven't got long back home down in Cardiff. They're back here on Monday evening at 7 o'clock with their principal conductor, Thomas Sundergaard, Shostakovich 11th Symphony, Prokofiev 2nd Violin Concerto with Daniel Hope. Well, Tchaikovsky said that he relied on Beethoven particularly for his symphonic structures, and he said that Beethoven used the dance in his symphonies, so why shouldn't he, Tchaikovsky, use the dance when he was accused of doing so? We'll hear Beethoven symphonies and the dance in the 7th Symphony tomorrow evening at 7:30. BBC Philharmonic and principal conductor Juan Homena will be performing that work. Also, the dance continues tomorrow night with Spanish Flair, the Fallia's three-cornered hat folk ballet, with Clara Maurice, the mezzo-soprano soloist, and Ravel's Bolero, not forgetting a world premiere, John McCabe's intriguingly titled Joy Box. That's tomorrow here on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, where every prom is live, but with Jacques Van Steen bringing the BBC National Orchestra of Wales to its feet. Time to head for the calm of Broadcasting House, where James Jolly is waiting to host the rest of your Radio 3 evening.
Thanks very much, Martin. That was Martin Handley at the Royal Albert Hall. And there's another chance to hear tonight's prom on Friday afternoon at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. And don't forget that every prom you can hear for 7 days online via the Radio 3 website. And talking of the proms, here's Andrew McGregor.
A BBC Proms concert exploring the twin keys of C major and C minor. Pianist Paul Lewis plays Mozart's elegant C major concerto number 25. And Daniel Harding and the Mahler Chamber Orchestra make a welcome return to the BBC Proms. Join me, Andrew McGregor, Tuesday night at 7:30.
Well, after the high drama of Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony, which ended the proms, something completely different. Piano music by Federico Mompou.
Thank you. Three piano pieces by the Catalan Federico Mompou, played by Arkady Volodos.
Over on BBC Radio 4.
The principal value is personal liberty. Freedom of dressing as you like, enjoying a glass of beer in a hot summer day.
As Turkey looks east and embraces its Ottoman heritage, Alan Little examines the tension behind the recent unrest.
Erdogan has asserted the supremacy of his own religiously inspired ideology, but it has collided with the voice of an emerging global middle class.
There are lots of people who are really concerned about their personal rights.
Turkey, the new Ottomans, over on BBC Radio 4, next Tuesday morning at 9.
This is BBC.